That's when we burned the boats and went all in. It's time for me to do what I love and enjoy, iterating quickly instead of making a perfect product. We got a strong signal that there are early adopters that love it. My job is just solve problems.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Breakout CEO Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Holman with Intellectual Strategies, and I am here to help explore some of the pivotal moments that scaling CEOs navigate as they start and grow their businesses. And since I can't share all of my confidential client stories with you, I bring guests on who've done pretty amazing things and are building awesome companies. And today we've got Art Jessup with us. Art, hey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I'm really glad to have you. I saw your product come out. I was thinking it might have been a couple of years ago, but you clarified for me before we started recording here that it was just maybe the beginning of 2025 when you launched your Kickstarter. So I guess maybe something about this product feels familiar enough that I thought I had seen it before that. So we'll get into that and hear about your product and your company and you know what you're building. But first, give the audience a flavor of who you are, and I want to bring back in something we talked about in our icebreaker segment earlier. You're a trail runner, right? Can I say that?
Yeah, trail runner, non-biker, you know, road runner as well. So
yeah, so you're out and about. Like, does that? I know I've run with a lot of people in the past. I do some mountain biking. I did a lot of high school here in Utah. We've got the high school mountain biking teams. When your kids get to that age, I highly recommend it. It's probably already on your radar. Do you identify as a runner or as a, I mean, does this help define who you are or is this just something you do?
No, it's really just something I do. I've noticed the more I tell people I run, the more annoyed they get. So I try to not bring it up. But yeah, I mix it up though with mountain biking, trail running, road running. But I definitely don't identify as a runner, but I enjoy it. It's my outlet.
I tell people I always enjoyed running. I am not built like a runner though. I'm not built like a cyclist either. So, for me, it was a little extra work, but no, that's interesting because, that crowd has a very, there are some people who are very, definitively defined by that role in their life. Do you, to compare, do you identify as an entrepreneur or, you know, what would you say if you had to label yourself? Would you give yourself a label?
Well, you know, I didn't grow up wanting to just always be an entrepreneur. I actually grew up wanting to be an investment banker and be part of that whole system. And also a pilot. I, you know, I did my license in high school and was always wanting to be a commercial pilot before investment banking. And then, you know, didn't end up going that path, but it's really not over till the last 5 years that the entrepreneurial bug has just really kicked in. Most people want to take risk when they're young and don't have kids. It's, for me, it's kind of been inverted, much to the detriment of my poor wife. She, you know, the stress and everything there, but it's really the last 5 years that something's just kind of unlocked. And maybe it's the experience from growing up in the corporate world, building that confidence. I'm not sure.
What do you mean by that? Like what, when you say unlocked, was there a moment or was there something that happened or a conversation? Like how did something get unlocked for you?
Yeah. So I've always kind of treated things of like, I'm the intern. I'm willing to do whatever, you know, throw me in, coach. I'll figure it out. I'll do it. A little bit unselfishly, right? Cause I always looked at it the long game. Like I'll learn from I'll build relationships.
Yeah.
About three, 4 years ago, something unlocked and just said, you know what? It's time for me to do what I love and enjoy instead of always just being, you know, a tool for someone else to use. Not in a bad way. Like a great employee, like a rockstar employee that, you know, you get thrown in, you're the Navy SEAL that parachutes in and you fix things. That's what I was always known for.
Yeah.
And it was really a couple of years ago, I just said, I'm ready to do what I'm passionate about, what I want to do versus what other people need. That was kind of the unlock. And that's where the entrepreneurial, you know, juices started to really flow.
That's interesting. Cause I think, I've been with companies and helping companies, I've seen some companies where I've thought to myself, man, these guys have a lot of employees, not just numbers, just people who, you know, they fill the employee role really well. right? And sometimes I'm like, man, why are these employees sticking around? There's a, you know, I work with startups, and startups go through cycles. And sometimes in the down cycles, you're like, more people are sticking around than you would expect. But then nothing wrong with that. It's just a contrast, like you're doing, the certain mindsets of maybe just operating and executing for others versus for yourself. How did you know when you wanted to do something different that that building your own company would be it? Did you just automatically say, oh, time to build my own thing, and you had, and like you just jumped in there, or was this a process to kind of discover where you wanted to be?
It was certainly a process. For the last 5 years, I've kicked around different ideas. You know, no, that doesn't work. Someone's done it. And yeah. I have a friend who started a company when he was in his early 20s. I just went and did it. And I've always been scared of that. Like, you know, things are going to fall apart. You know, it's always been a very risk, risk off mentality. And like I said, that unlock was a few years ago. That's just like, I found a product that resonated with me. It's something I absolutely needed. It didn't exist in the market. Went out in the garage and started building it, tinkering, and started traveling with this proof of concept, and people loved it. They wanted to buy one.
Yeah.
And that's really where the unlock kind of is like, hey, this is a product that I built myself. I'm passionate about it. I need it. It kind of hits the three things for me. I love products that transform. Mm-hmm. I love to travel. And I'm kind of a workaholic. And so Base Cases really does all of this. It transforms. I use it for my work, and you use it for your travel. So, okay. So that was like the three things for me that just had this unlock that I was like, this is the it's all the direction, is the signal. And then the name of the company is what really like propelled me. So
yeah.
I was on my mountain bike thinking about this idea. I have a case. What can I call it? And I don't want it to be some generic like Arthur case or travel case.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted my family's identity involved in it. And so I started thinking like, how could I put my kids' name in the brand, but still have a really nice name?
Yeah.
And so I used the initials of my three kids, and that's how I came up with Base Case. And it clicked in 2 seconds. Now that's to me is like, hey, this is going to work. I just know it. And so my firstborn is Brooks Arthur, my daughter Scarlett Ellen, and then our third is Baylor Craig, and that's the Base Case. And then my wife is Ashley Ellen, and she's in there twice. So everything just kind of like
the whole thing's
this
covered.
This is supposed to be
Oh man, well, so Base Case is your first jump into the entrepreneur world, or did you do any, you know, any other attempts at businesses before this, or this was the first thing?
I've been involved in a few little startups, but it wasn't my idea. It wasn't my company. This is the first, like I went all in, burned the boats, walked away from a very good corporate job.
Yeah.
And just said, it's going to work. We have to make it work. You can't really start a company without that mentality. If you go into it like, hey, I got these backups. If this doesn't work, I can go back to my corporate job. Yeah. You probably are not going to be able to build a product that's this complex, that has a global supply chain, you have mechanical, you got electrical, everything involved as your first product. It's probably going to be impossible without that mindset. So you have to burn the boats and go all in, but you also got to be smart about it. You got to be prepared. You got to have a product that you've got to have done your homework before you burn the boats. So that's really done the story.
You mentioned some earlier risk aversion. How did you feel the confidence to make this leap? Because like you're saying, you know, I talked with a lot of people who they come there, like, I got this idea. I'm gonna, you know, it's a great idea. My parents told me it's a $1 billion idea, and someone's gonna pay me a bunch of money just to have this because it's gonna save the world. I talked to somebody a month ago. They have some ideas about how to save the Great Salt Lake, and I'm like, that's awesome. But how do you get from where you're at today, which was, you know, unresourced and unskilled and, you know, to the point of doing that? Like there's so much that goes into it. How did you kind of find the confidence to take that leap? Because are you do you have an engineering background or a sales background or, you know, where'd that confidence come from?
None. I got a very engineering mindset, but no engineering training other than financial engineering. But really, it's come from that intern mentality, just jumping in, learning as much as I can. So over the last 5 years, I went from a finance more into like operations, private equity, and learned a great deal about supply chain, because all our portfolio companies were having issues with supply chain during COVID. So as the Navy SEAL, that would jump in and help establish and clean up. And without that knowledge, I wouldn't have had the confidence to start this. So really that intern mentality and maturity, you know, taking the time. I'd say some of the best entrepreneurs that you probably don't hear about are the guys that started in their 40s. You know, they don't have the sexy tech startup, but it's these sleeper companies that are worth probably a couple billion that a guy started when he's 40 or 50 years old that, you know, maybe not tech, but just compounded over years and decades. So really having that maturity is what kind of flipped the risk profile for me.
Yeah. And I don't usually get into this part, but you brought up your wife, and, you know, wives, spouses, partners put up with a lot through this. How does she deal with this?
Just a quick note about our guests. I host the Breakout CEO podcast to share behind the scenes insights from scaling businesses. As an attorney, I see the real challenges leaders face long before success becomes public. But client stories have to stay confidential. So we invite guest CEOs to share their own moments of struggle and success. I'm so grateful to our guests and my team at Intellectual Strategies for making this show possible. Now, let's get back to the show.
And we are far from the finish line. But, you know, it's been very stressful, very tough on a marriage. But, you know, I'd say communication, I'm not the best at it, but we're doing better. Having to be able to sit down and just talk, taking a break from the kids with her is, you know, it's hard, easier said than done, but it's a must.
Yeah. Well, and I'm one who works with my wife. So my wife is the operational brain of our law firm. So I know the struggles. I know the complexities of it. It works for us. It doesn't for everybody. So,
that's impressive that you can do that.
It's a display of her. It's a display of her patience, probably more than anything. Patience with me, of course. But she's very good at what she does. Well, so you started doing this. Tell me, what was the issue where you're like, I need to put, well, why don't you describe what the product is, and then maybe explain how you determined that this would be a product line worth, you know, starting a business around?
Yeah, so essentially what we've created is a full portable command center, command and control center, workstation, that's in a sleek, elegant suitcase. So you think of that, a lot of people are like, oh, that's kind of lame. And then I show it to people and they're like, wow, I was not expecting that. How innovative and sleek and how well you guys designed this. But really the product was born out of, I worked fully remote, but traveled a ton. We'd always be at like acquisition targets, be set up in the conference room, working on your teeny laptop and your extender screen.
Yeah.
I'm like, if I just had my full office like I do at my house, like the 32-inch dual screens and your laptop, if I just had that everywhere I went, I could be wicked efficient, like one on all the road. And so I'm like, why does that not exist? You know, you've got the little extender screens that go in your backpack, but I'm like, no, I need a new category. I need like a full dual screen system that can raise, that's clean. I hate wires everywhere. I need it to be plug and play. So I went on the Google machine, Amazon machine. I didn't find it. It didn't exist. And so I'm like, well, I was kind of due for a project. Like as a kid, I'd go out and tinker in the garage and build things. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take a suitcase off the shelf. We're going to get this thing. We had to re-engineer it.
Yeah.
And because a regular suitcase opens like this. We needed it to open like a hot dog, you know? So it's like your horizontal.
So you're taking zippers off and re-sewing stuff?
No, these were hard shell case.
Okay.
No zippers. So we did this, and then I had to find an engineer to help me with the legs that telescope out of the case. So everything's fully integrated.
Okay.
There's no attachments. So it's fully integrated. They come out and they spin, and then this thing can raise to three different heights depending on your preference. And then it's fully plug and play. And, so we built the initial proof of concept, and then we built a prototype. And then our breakout moment was going to the Consumer Electronics Show. And I was still working my full-time job, three kids, you know, just crazy. But we got a booth at the CES in Las Vegas. And
what year was this?
Never been. This was 2025, January.
Okay, so just a year and a half ago.
Yeah. So we had no idea what to expect. We went down there and it was just mayhem. Like everyone is like, to be honest, this is probably the most practical thing we've seen, you know, because everything's AI this and AI that.
Right.
It's like, no, it's all we've done is we've kind of made screens kind of fun again, you know, because the way it deploys and how fast. And so we had people showing up to our booth, like completely, we had never done this before, but we had the Secret Service.
What?
We had a massive
Secret Service as buyers and researchers, nothing clandestine, right?
No, it was their technology division that they were just walking the floor and they showed up and now they're a customer, you know?
How interesting.
And then we had a big hedge fund that stopped by, one of the biggest in the world. And they had actually been following us on our social media because we had started doing ads and building for our crowdfunding campaign. And so we had all this interest and I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? Like I had no idea what to expect, you know? And then we went to Shark Tank because they had an audition there.
Yeah.
And we wait in line, go through the audition. They're like, oh, we've already heard of you guys. We're planning on to reach out to you. So, So that was, we never made the show. We got to like the 1 foot line and then, you know, didn't make it. But anyways, so that was our first breakout moment. And that's where the unlock is like, okay, there is clearly resonating. This is interesting to a niche. And so that's when we burned the boats and went all in.
I want to hear more about that. But I want to back up if I can, because I imagine there were a couple moments leading up to this where you were, you know, like you mentioned, you were building prototypes, you were testing them. And I have this picture in my mind. You can tell me if this ever happened or not. Of you, you know, going to one of were you still going to these offsite meetings and you show up, you know, in the conference room and everyone pulls out their laptops and you're like, by the way, for the audience who's, if you're watching the video, you've got one of these, you know, on the
desk behind you.
Yeah. And you're sitting there and you pull this thing out, and people are kind of like, what's this guy got to get out of his suitcase? And all of a sudden you open this up and you got, you know, dual monitors and stand like, was there a moment like that integrated. Where people are like, what are you doing? Where'd you get that?
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone asked where I bought it. It's like, clearly I didn't purchase that. This is very rudimentary. We built this. And so,
but
it was fun. People were like, where did you buy this? How did you build it? This is amazing. It sells itself. Cause I want one right now.
Yeah.
Things like that. So,
you were doing, call it technical feasibility, right? Lugging this around and carrying it through airports probably. But you were also doing a little bit of market validation along the way with people who I suspect a lot of the people in those rooms have the money to buy this and would be your target market if it had been available at the time. Is that right?
Yeah, 100%. So like CES was market testing, validation, and then just taking it. I've set this thing up in the Delta Sky Lounge more times than I could count, you know? I've sold these at the Delta Sky Lounge. People set it up. People walk by like, what is this? They're taking photos and I've had people buy it right there. So the natural thing with Base Case is when it's set up, it's a natural billboard. I mean, they're big, huge screens. You roll in with a carry-on suitcase and in 30 seconds, I have this thing deployed and the screens are on it. People are like, where did that come from?
No, it with all the wires and plugs and everything.
Yeah. You got these dual 24-inch screens in the Sky Lounge and people can see your email, but it's a great marketing opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it. Well, and so that's when you said, you showed up to CES, you weren't sure what to expect. I imagine you had you'd built some level of confidence with the reaction you'd received up to that point.
But it had been a really small sample size.
Yeah. Very, very, just
so we went into CES really not knowing. Like I was like, there's a chance we spent a ton of money. I was on PTO during CES, you know, man in this booth. And so,
Well, what did the team look like really at the time?
Know. It was me. And we had a couple engineers on contract. You know, I had hired an engineering firm, you know,
Got it. So you were really putting yourself out there. At what point did you? So you're at CES, and that's a week long thing. Are you out displaying the full week, or how?
Yeah, you're on the floor for 4 days. It's brutal.
that is brutal. Well, so you got a good reaction, and they do awards and stuff there. I don't know if you what did you walk away with from CES in addition to a bunch of contacts? Like what did CES tell you?
Yeah, CES told me that there's clearly this resonates with the right audience. So like the Secret Service, hedge funds, the guys that had come to our booth and actually had known about us. We'd also had people that showed up and like, yeah, I've seen your stuff. I'm glad I ran into you because I've been wanting to see if this is real. We had people that were like, I'm one of your pre-backers for your crowdfund because we did this whole you know, when you build this community before you launch a crowdfund, we had people in our community showing up to our booth, and we were only a few months in. So that was like, okay, like this is resonating. If you have, you know, Citadel Securities and you got the Secret Service that are coming to your booth and telling you like, this is really interesting, we want to explore this. That's a pretty strong signal for me. It was like, okay, we're going to figure this out. Cause I can't do this. You know, working full time. So in March, we went full time on it, 2025, and have a look back.
Okay. And tell me about the crowdfunding. Was that in between CES and going full time or around the same time?
Yeah, that was in February, right after CES.
Yep. Okay. What went into the, for someone who hasn't done one of these, we don't need to go through every detail, but for someone who has not done a crowdfunding campaign, what surprised you, both the good and the bad, in that process?
Yeah, I would say the biggest surprise for me was learning the law of large numbers, the funnel. You start with 10,000 people on your email list. You get 1,000 people that become a VIP. Out of that, 300 people commit. It's just the sales funnel, the marketing funnel. You know, I'd never really been on the marketing side to that extent where you're like in the weeds, in the trenches, emailing people like individually, figuring out what's making them interested. The other side of that was how many people believed in me and our team to give us $1,500 for a product. It was kind of a pipe dream.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of crowdfunds that never actually come to market. And, you know, we had our prototypes, but they are so far from a mass produced item. There's a difference between prototyping and mass production, massive gap.
Yeah.
And so having, you know, that many people say, here is $1,500. I've never met you in my life, but I believe in you and I trust you. I'm like, well, that's huge, you know? So we had at the end, by the time we shipped, we had about 500 pre-orders, and those were all resting on my shoulders, and it was getting very heavy.
Yeah.
But the belief, people believing in you is like, it's a huge, huge motivator. Then we did deliver. We did deliver, and to way past everyone's expectations. The amount of people is like, I've backed tons of crowd funds. I've never seen the product sold, and it came out better than what I was expecting.
Oh, so really?
I give all the credit to Josh, our head engineer. He's amazing. So.
Well, so 500 units of 1,500 units, is that 750? Did I do my real-time math roughly correctly?
Sorry.
You guys raised about 750 in the crowdfunding?
Yeah. By that time, it was all said and done. Some of it was on our Shopify post crowdfund. Yeah. So funny thing about crowdfunding, it's very public. People would walk up and be, hey, Art, you guys are crushing it. I'm like, how do you know? Oh, that's right. It's all online. You can see exactly what you've raised.
I've always been curious because I've helped some clients who've had successful fundraisers there, and some who have tried to have successful fundraisers. I've always wondered, for those that do well, and you bring this up, you know, they believed in you. I think some people go there and they think, well, if I just have a cool product, that'll do it. But you didn't just say, hey, I have a cool product and people wanted the product. You're like, no, people believed in me. Did you purposefully create the messaging to take that into account as you launched your crowdfunding? Or was it just simply the product is out there, let me tell you how cool the product is, and then you realize after the fact, oh wait, that was an investment in me in addition to the product?
Yeah, I never thought of it in that way. I thought that the product was cool enough because I believed in it. You know, mm-hmm. I was like, this product really is cool. I love it. I use it every day. And this should sell itself. However, with crowdfunding, most crowdfunds are a pretty small ticket item. They're not a $1,500. You have a few, like some e-bikes that are higher.
Yeah. But,
you know, a lot of crowdfunding is games. It's $40. It's $50.
Right.
You know, ours was $1,500. So completely different, you know, level. But for me, it was always like, these guys will buy it because the product. But at the end of the day, it was that, but they're taking a bet on you.
Yeah. I imagine some of that is just realizing as the pledges roll in, the commitment builds and you start to say to yourself, oh, I gotta make this work now. I gotta do this and make it work.
It's another form of burning the boats. Like these guys have believed, like they're at it. So you have to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so that was February, and I think you
mentioned February 2025.
And the product came out earlier this year.
February 2026. Yeah.
Yeah. How did that process go to go from the working prototypes that you had in whatever form they were to getting a commercial product out to your crowd?
10 times harder than I would have ever expected. It was relentless. Thankfully, we have a great team. Josh, who I mentioned earlier, he's been to mm-hmm. China 6 times in less than a year.
Yeah.
Just spending the time with our manufacturing partners, figuring out how to DFM, which means to design for manufacturing. Like I said, mm-hmm. going from prototype to mass production is like, it's a whole education. So really refining our designs over the summer, you know, settling in on your vendors, then finishing the designs for your injection molding, which is, by the way, terrifying because these, these molds are tens of thousands of dollars. And if you don't have a perfect, then that's tens of thousands of dollars and time that you're losing. So making that final decision is super hard. And then just like bare knuckle brawl, just you have to be on your partners, your suppliers, like 24/7. And to the point where they probably don't like you anymore, but we got to the finish line. A lot of people doubted that we'd ever hit our timeline. We did have to extend a little bit, but a lot of people are like, this is a 2-year project.
I was just going to say 1 year to bring a new product to market that needs all of that design work. I mean, you weren't just, you know, printing new labels on some commodity product. You had to put things together, create an entirely new product. 12 months, that's not a typical time frame, is it?
No, not at all. And honestly, it'd be hard to do that for us now because we've got other sides of the business we have to worry about. Back mm-hmm. then, this was the only thing. This was the thing that we had to work on, right? So that's the beauty about being a startup is how fast you can move. But once you get other product lines and a team, the things are slowing down tremendously. So, but we're going to try to keep that hustle, keep that iteration fast, like, you know, the SpaceX model, a little bit, you know, fire than aim.
Yeah, let's get into that in a moment. I just want to ask, have you had a chance to go to China yourself or go over and see the machines and the molds and... fascinating world, isn't it, to be walking through those factories and seeing where the products are actually made and how they do it. Like I love it every time I get a chance to go over there.
Yeah, absolutely. I went over in August and then also in November of last year. So
I imagine you were in Shenzhen, is that right?
Shenzhen, Dongguan, another place up north called Zhangzhou. Okay. Probably mispronouncing that, but
I haven't been there. No, I love it. It's amazing. And so you've built your team up, it sounds like, since the CES days. What does your team look like today?
Yeah, so we still rely on some contractors, but we've got about 6 people in full time on the team now. Still rely on some fractional sure. engineering. But we do have a couple engineers on staff, which has been great. It's hard to outsource that. Especially with our product, there's certain things that you just have to be all in to really understand the product. You know,
what do you mean by that? Are they you just have to be full time or you have to be, you know, fully dedicated?
Just,
what does that mean?
Just dedicated. You know, if you're working on 4 other clients, you know, design it's hard to know like some of this institutional knowledge. For instance, we have these legs that come out of the case and they spin. Mm-hmm. And that's how the case stabilizes and elevated. We had a spring on the foot that pops it out. And okay. We had some issues with that spring. We were going into mass production and the legs kept popping out. We'd be walking down the sidewalk and it pops out. That doesn't work. You know, that's going to be a huge recall. And we're at CES this last January, 2026. We were going into mass production and we had this influencer that had one of our cases and he was walking around CES and the leg kept popping out. He's like, guys, you got a big problem here. I'm like, we got people at the booth and Josh and I held it all up and we're like, we cannot manufacture 1,000 cases with the legs popping out. Mm. So we went in a triage mode and we got that fixed and resolved, but we can tell if it has the wrong spring because we know our product so well.
Yeah.
We know if that spring is the spring that's going to pop out or if it's a spring that's going to stay secured. You know, and that just comes with just intimately knowing that product, like every square centimeter.
Wow. I think it also illustrates another point too that I see a fair amount with clients. Then that is there are so many details to a product that you have to know. And from the outside, it's easy to look at these and be like, it's a suitcase with some legs and some monitors in it. Put a few cables in and, you know, you're there. I could redo this myself in a matter of months. But when you get into it, you see all of the nitty gritty details. And not only are those details that you have to solve, maybe, you know, figure out as in kind of more of a problem mindset, but I see that and I see a lot of people come back and they're like, hey, I was working on my product. And when I got into XYZ, I realized there was this issue. And in order to solve it, I actually had to invent a new piece that doesn't exist anymore. So now I have a product and I want to patent this part of it. So you start to see the problems and it opens the door into the innovations that you're actually mm-hmm. creating. So have you seen many of those innovations along the way or your whole product is an innovation, but do you see it more granularly than that?
Yeah, we had a customer that came to us. They do mission planning for the F-35. So they're a Lockheed Martin subcontractor. They reached out to us. They saw our initial prototypes. And this was early during crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And they asked if we could come to an event they had. They had 20 NATO countries at their facility in Orlando. And they wanted to show our cases for like portable, like tactical mission planning. Mm-hmm. So we go down there and show the cases. They agreed to buy some of our prototypes. And then they're like, could you guys stack these? Like, we need to actually 4 screens. And I'm like, what? Like, never thought of that. But the way our case is designed, we have these locks that how the case closes and stays shut, the locks.
Okay.
We're actually able to use that infrastructure to take a second case, stack it, and we just printed off these clips. We're able to just connect them. And now we came up with this whole other product line that was a customer's need. Wasn't ever even on our radar. And now we have this 4-screen command center that we call Quadzilla. And I can set this up in, you know, less than a minute. And now that's become a huge product for backup 911 dispatch.
Yeah.
For command and control, for drone operators, for fire, you know, the whole emergency management public safety world was never on our radar. And now we went to this little teeny trade show. We set up Quadzilla and everyone's coming out of the woodwork like, holy crap, that is our backup dispatch center. That is our dispatch center in a box. And so it's these little things where you're like, how are we going to stack and you innovate and you create and then you have a product line that was never even in your thinking to begin with. So those are the fun things.
That's awesome. Yeah. And that's how I look at some companies and I'm like, you know, you see their product and then you're like, oh, they have 13 patents. They have 70 patents or whatever. You're like, well, it's because they're actually patenting the problems that they're solving, you know, the solutions to the problems that they're solving or the opportunities that they're jumping on. So that's pretty cool. I have to ask though, why do command centers? Cause I don't know. I don't work in one. Why do command centers prefer the Quadzilla, the 4-screen layout?
So they're normally working with 6 to 8 screens, like a dispatcher. You know, they've got screens on top of screens.
Okay.
And, you know, they've got their CAD, their computer aided dispatch. They've got their RMS. They usually have like some camera footage, their messaging platform. You know, there's a lot going on. And so for them, if they have to evacuate their dispatch center, they've got to take their laptop and go set up in a conference room.
Yeah.
Some municipalities have a full emergency operations center on standby, but a lot do not. That's a $5 to $10 million investment. So if they can buy some base cases and they can stack Quadzilla, they can use these head across town set up in minutes.
Yeah.
That's an excellent backup solution, but it's also multi-use. They could be using these every day and then, you know, use it in emergency.
That's fascinating. Well, it illustrates that, you know, your customer. You're telling me stuff that I bet 2 years ago, you didn't know much about command centers. And now
I didn't know much about command centers. And that's the breakout that we're starting to find is that ICP, the ideal customer profile. Mm-hmm. We've really narrowed in the last few months and said, okay, we're going to just focus on these groups. We're going to go all in. We're going to learn everything we can about them. We're going to go to every trade show that we can, and we're going to just dedicate ourselves. So I'm dropping acronyms I didn't know, you know, a few months ago. And it's been really helpful. It's been beneficial. The power of focus. And instead of trying to serve every industry, which we could be, you know, let's focus on two and go all in on it. And then we can eventually build the team to focus on everyone else, but we can't right now. So limited resources, we got to get incredibly focused, narrow in on the ideal customer profile, the ICP, and then let's go perfect those and then build out from there.
Well, you're pretty early stage though. And I think a lot of early stage companies are like, I'll sell to anybody. Like I just got to make sales. In fact, you said earlier on how focused you are in sales. Maybe that was in our initial icebreaker segment, but what was the prompting for you to say, you know what, we got to narrow down, we got to niche down, we got to define the ICP? Because being a year or two in, that's you're moving fast towards, you know, marketing to a specific segment, it seems like.
Yeah, it really came from a friend who's that young entrepreneur I told you about earlier that just went and did it. He I was bragging to him like, oh, we could do this and this and this and this, all these industries, you know. Mm-hmm. We're working with T-Pain, we're working with the Secret Service, we're working with the special ops teams. And he's like, who's your customer? I'm like, all these guys. He's like, no.
Yeah.
Who's your top three? And I honestly couldn't answer it. I was like, honestly, I don't know. He's like, there's your problem.
You're like, what do you mean?
Laser focus. Yeah. But he's like, well, you can't do all that. You've got to find your top three and go all in on that. And so that's what we've done, you know, the last three months.
But this is a natural staging thing, right? Like when you launch your crowdfunder, it's kind of like, let's validate this across a broad set audience. Like you're not even necessarily targeting any particular ICP at that point. You're just like, if you're on Kickstarter, you might be our audience, right?
But you're figuring out who your audience is. You're figuring out if there's, what's the signal? Is this even applicable? You know, so we got a strong signal that there are early adopters that love it, you know, and now we're at that stage where like, hey, we're clearly a B2B. People do not buy this to go to Starbucks and set up and write a novel. They're using this for their business. They're using this, their accountant, they're a lawyer. So we've identified we're B2B. And now what businesses are we going all in on? We'll take everyone's revenue. We'll take sales.
Sure.
What shows are we going to that we're going to be the best educated, the relationships we're building? We've also found this very impactful partner program. We're trying to get in the doors of like the sheriff's department. We're trying to get in the doors of like Dallas City.
Yeah.
Well, you can call and cold call and go to the front door and like wait in the lobby, and it's hard. But we found that we've got all these software companies that sell, they're already selling into, you know, Dallas or Houston. And we say, well, our products are incredibly complementary. You need to set up a dual screen anyways to demo your product, to sell, to do training. We'll just let you take one. And so it's like the Trojan horse effect. They just roll into City Hall, set up a base case, and everyone's like, what?
Wait a second, what is this?
And it's been an incredibly successful lead generation for us. So we had a massive order quote request from the U.S. Marines that came in, very same thing.
Really? Because it puts a partner, sets the, you gave a partner.
Sets it up in a trade show booth or a training.
Yeah. Well, that makes me wonder. And I do need to, we need to get back to the SpaceX stuff in a minute, but because I know you had some comments about that. But are you, when you do this, there's real brand opportunity here, right? I mean, your case by itself, the product itself is branding for the company, for the product. Have you done anything else, or have you said, how do we amplify the branding opportunity when people are already drawn to the product when it's in use?
Yeah, we've had recently, the other breakout was really figuring out how to tell the story in a social media setting and have it go viral. We've had three consecutive videos that have gone viral, and we kind of unlocked the how we sell it. It's not a high end video. It's very low production. And it's us just opening the case and saying base case about 1,000 times.
Oh, really?
So we've figured out this kind of format. But then we had a guy who came to our booth at CES this last year. Mm-hmm. His format is he interviews you setting up your product. He goes to trade shows. That's his thing. He's got 1.2 million followers. His name's Stanley Genedek. He launched his video of us at CES last week, and it has over 2 million views, and it's just brought this incredible amount of interest. It like really like it's, you know, it's gone viral. Wow. And from all over the world. So that's been a huge unlock of breakout. Just insane. Like I can't keep up with the inbound interest, people asking about it. And it's not all converting to sales, but it's getting the name out, getting awareness.
Yep,
awareness. And partly it's the product. The product really does sell itself to the right audience.
Yeah. I love that. You're in the middle of so many things right now. How are you balancing the growth opportunity? I mean, I know you're narrowing your ICP, which is helping to control your, you know, your resource allocation, stuff like that. But with, when you have growth, it does become really hard operationally, strategically to really balance the growth and the fulfillment and the, you know, the team. Like, how do you think about that balance as you grow?
Yeah, it's been hard. I'm not going to lie. I've always been the systems, operations, finance, kind of behind the operations side. I've flipped that. Now I'm revenue, customer service. Like those two are like the most important. But really, I've got to delegate. That's where I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Learning how to delegate and bringing on guys that we can trust and that can do it. It's really hard when you're startup and the cash flow is, you know, still getting there.
Yeah, but for sure.
It's just, it's a wing and a prayer. You know, you got to figure it out, but we're getting there.
I love it. Now you mentioned SpaceX before. Tell me, what are your views on maybe parallels or how your product or your philosophy might, parallel what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX. And he's of course got a lot of attention with the recent IPO and all that.
No, I mostly mean just kind of their philosophy, obviously no comparison clearly, but they take approach of like, hey, the engineer should also be building the product instead of like, I engineer this, I throw it over the wall and then someone else, you know, builds it. So I'm a huge believer in that. Like, hey, if you're going to engineer this, you got to be able to build it as well. If you're going to engineer this, you should use the product, you know, so we eat our own cooking. I'm literally doing this podcast on a base case. Our engineers, they design on a base case. We don't use regular screens. And first off, that has been the best way to optimize and perfect and you know, iterate on our product is by using it. There'll be so many times I'm going through the bill of materials and I just look at the case. Okay, I forgot that part, you know, got my spreadsheet on the base case. But really, like eating your own cooking, iterating quickly, instead of making a perfect product, let's build something that's going to be good and let's get it out of the customer, get their feedback, iterate quickly. But also, let's build our own designs. Our first prototypes, we were designing it, getting the product shipped out, I was personally assembling it, you know, figuring it out. There's no better way to learn your product than physically assembling it yourself.
Yeah. Is that why you're able to, do you think that's why you're able to do kind of that 12-month cycle instead of a longer cycle? How did you know where to draw the line and say, okay, we gotta stop designing and start producing?
To where I felt comfortable with it, that our early adopters would enjoy it and like it and use it. There's still some things that I hate about it, but it's like a lot of people don't even comment about it. Like, oh, I don't mind that. I'm like, well, it's killing me. But like, well, they're the guys that are, you know, buying it, and if they hate it, okay, we built something good, especially for our first product. So there's a ton of times I have to sit the team down. I was like, let's give ourselves some credit here, because we're all beating ourselves up, like, this and that, you know, it's not great here. It's like, the customers aren't saying that. Yeah, customers love it. There's a few things they say, and we're working on it. But the thing about SpaceX, though, I will say, is we use what we call a Raptor engine mentality. So there's a photo out there you can actually go find, and it shows the iteration of the Raptor engine for the Falcon 9. The first one has wires and cords and stuff going everywhere. It looks like the rocket engine. And then the second iteration, you can see they've clearly refined it. There's still a few cables and pipes and things. And then the third iteration is absolutely beautiful. Looks like a Rolls Royce. And it's just beautiful rocket engine. So we're always, every day, we're like, get stressed out about the design, this and that. It's like, Raptor engine, we're going to get there, but not today.
Yeah.
Because if we get there today, then we'll never launch a product, because it takes time, takes iteration.
You can't wait to build perfection before you start selling, or you'll never be able to fund perfection, will you?
Correct.
Oh, I love that. Well, this is fantastic, Art. I'm so excited for where you're headed. And, you know, this, having seen your product a couple of years ago, and I'm like, what's the use case for that? How does it work? You know, I carry around my extender screen and, you know, work all the time while I'm traveling, just part of what I do. But the B2B play here, the emergency services, the defense industry, like this makes a ton of sense that they would be looking for the Quadzilla, you know, setup for what you're doing. So it's really exciting to hear all the progress you've made and the success that you've found so far. Where do you see this going? You know, the product, your team, the business, where is this headed?
We're leaning into that emergency management space, defense, like you said, and really trying to tailor it around portable command and control, ISR. So everything's going drone, you know, defense, very drone warfare. So really trying to tailor it for that, for the defense side, and then for the emergency management, really like reliability, innovation on touchscreen, compute inside the case, faster deployability. Believe it or not, like we can actually improve that, even though I can set this up in 30 seconds. But just there's a whole roadmap of products that we've got. It's exciting. I get really excited thinking about it. We just want to build a great product that resonate with people, that there's nothing better than a repeat buyer. Yeah, you know, we've got a startup company in Denver that's bought 15 of these, and not all at once. They've bought them over multiple cycles. And that's the best thing, is when you have a customer that comes back and buys more of your product. That's the true stamp of like approval. And so we want to just keep that going.
What do you think it's going to take to get to the next level or two for your business? In addition to maybe sales is the easy answer, right? Where do you see building and growing internally within your business to get to those next levels?
Yeah, improving on our current product. There's a lot of things we're doing to ruggedize it, to make it more applicable for a defense or emergency space, you know, weatherproofing, all that stuff. I don't want to get too far in the details and technicalities, but continuing to make a product that is so easy and plug and play, remove a lot of friction for setup, things like that, where, you know, my mom could set it up and be working. You know, that's really the goal. If you have to have an IT guy set up for you, you're probably on the wrong path.
Makes sense. And if there's one thing that our audience, if somebody listening to this could bring to your team, either a skill or a resource, what would be one of the most useful things that you'd be like, oh, we'd love to have some more of that.
Probably another really, really good mechanical engineer.
Awesome. Well, maybe there's one out there listening that says, I've been looking for something to tackle.
Yeah.
So I love that. Well, Art, this has been fantastic. For CEOs who are out there who have, you know, been on a journey like yours, or maybe they're a little ahead of you but haven't experienced all the bumps, or they're a little behind you and saying, man, if I can make it as far as Art, you know, that's the next stage for me. What would you say to those people as they're, you know, traversing similar paths as you are?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is approaching every day of like, my job is just solve problems. Today is not going to go perfect. If you go in every day thinking, oh, today's going to be smooth, then this probably isn't for you. If you switch your mindset and say, today we're going to have a ton of stuff that doesn't go right, and my job is just to like figure those out and solve them, then it's actually not that bad. It's stressful, but it's like, it's just a mindset shift. Like if I come in being like, crap's going to hit the fan, that's all right, because I'm ready for it. Like I'm excited to tackle those problems. Then the startup life isn't too bad. So, but it's not for everybody.
Maybe there's a way we can like make a t-shirt or a hat or something. It isn't that bad. Yeah. You got this. It isn't that bad. Well, Art, thank you so much for sharing your insights here and your story. You know, there's, as always, talking with you and other CEOs, there's so many details that we can't really see from the outside. There's the behind the scenes things that are happening that just aren't present on the website. So it's really insightful and helpful, I think, for other scaling CEOs and aspiring CEOs to hear those stories. So thank you for sharing that with us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
And for our audience who's listened to the episode today, thanks for joining us again on the Breakout CEO Podcast.
Be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.